Welcome to this episode of Want to Hear Something Interesting, a podcast where your hosts Scott Ahern and Chad Knight discuss a topic using research and personal opinion. The topics will be wide and varied, but approached with a researcher's eye. Will everything we say be 100% accurate? Probably not, but we are striving to be as accurate as we can be. Every month on the 1st, a new topic will come your way. Occasionally, though not usually, there may be some language of the adult variety. Listener, be warned. Now, here are your hosts, Scott and Chad.
Hello, and welcome to Want to Hear Something Interesting, Episode 8. I'm Scott, and with me as always is... Hey, give that back!
No! I stole it fair and square. It's mine now.
I'm afraid my co-host has gotten into character a little too soon. Chad, please give me back my notes.
Fine. They're just worthless paper anyway. This is Chad. This is Erden the Grey.
And today, we're going to talk about the history and cultural significance of Dungeons & Dragons, or D&D as it's commonly called. Chad is going to set the scene for us by talking about how the game came to be, including how he met one of the creators. We'll probably talk on and on about all the games we have played, both before we met and where we were in the same game. We'll wrap up with me talking a little about the impact D&D has had on society, good and bad, in terms of economics, pop culture, and education. Chad, take us back.
I would love to. And in fact, I'm going to take us back, I guess now technically, since the article I have here from Wizards only goes through 2014, and that was 40 years. So I'm going to take us back 43 years?
Roughly.
All right. So Dungeons & Dragons influenced so many games that followed in different media and genres, but it has remained a vital product in its own right, appearing in diverse editions, media, and languages, as well as spinning off into literature, film, television, and the internet. It has been a source of inspiration for artists of many kinds, but more importantly, it has enriched the lives of tens of millions around the globe, offering a chance for anyone to experience fantastic roles in situations very different from everyday life. On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of Dungeons & Dragons and the release of an eagerly awaited new edition, this timeline shows some important dates in the development, elaboration, and the triumph of Dungeons & Dragons. Now, that brings us into this 40-year timeline. As everybody out there knows, if there's a timeline, I will find it.
That is true.
Because I think they encompass a high-level oversight of what we're going to be talking about. And since you and I have spent so much of our lives doing this...
True.
I got a feeling that as we talk through this, we're going to have more to say than just what's on the timeline.
I would definitely agree with that.
All right, so 1967, right about the year you were born, isn't it?
A little early. I'm 1970.
Okay. So in 1967, the International Federation of Wargaming, the IFW, founded by Gary Gygax and others, provides a venue for wargame fans to exchange ideas and amateur game designs. 1968, Gygax holds the first Lake Geneva Wargames Convention, or Gen Con, in the Horticultural Hall of his hometown of Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, as an IFW event. 1969, Gygax meets Dave Arneson at the second Gen Con, and the two express a mutual interest in collaborating on game rules. And then 1970, the Lake Geneva Tactical Studies Association, a small war games club, is founded. Initial membership includes Gygax and Don Kay. Due to his growing interest in the medieval period, Gygax forms the Castle and Crusade Society, a subgroup of the IFW focused on medieval wargaming. Members are assigned property in an imaginary continent called the Great Kingdom. Arneson joins shortly thereafter. Now, the big step comes in 1971. In 1971, Chainmail, written by Gygax and Jeff Perrin, is published by Gideon Games. It details fantastic medieval miniature warfare, including wizards, heroes, and dragons. Arneson uses chainmail as rules for his Blackmoor fantasy campaign situated in the Great Kingdom, including forays into a dungeon of monsters and treasure. There's the spark.
Yeah.
There's that when it went from wargaming, which most gamers I think realize our hobby came out of wargaming.
Yes.
Which is why we still use miniatures to this day.
Correct.
But where wargaming was this huge expanse where you were in charge of either a real historical combat unit or a fantasy combat group, you were always like the general over an entire, you know, whether entire army.
Right.
What happens here, where 71, the big thing is this chainmail is written not only to be less, well, it's still wargaming, but it's become fantastical. It's become fantasy-based.
Yes. So instead of reenacting famous battles from history, or, say, for example, taking the Napoleonic cavalry and pitting them against the Confederate foot soldiers, you're taking medieval-style war parties, but including elements of fantasy literature, dragons, wizards, things like that.
Exactly. So then in 1972, let me step back there for a second. Arneson took those rules of chainmail and made them even more of a fantasy campaign, which started, you know, the dungeon crawls, the coming across monsters that weren't, you know, another army, that kind of stuff. So in 1972, that summer, Arneson publishes Facts About Blackmoor via issue number 13 of the Castle and Crusade Society newsletter, the Domesday Book, which brings his activities to a wider audience. Later in the year, Arneson demonstrates the Blackmoor game for Gygax in Lake Geneva. Dave McGarry then demonstrates his own Dungeons of Pashakata, later to be published as Dungeon the Board Game. Did you get a chance to talk with Dave when he was at Evercon last year?
Just briefly. He was mainly regaling members of the audience with stories of playing Dungeon and developing Dungeons.
So. Right, and you know, he's one of those rare guys out there. He created Dungeon. That's it. You know, and after that, he went on to work in the computer industry. It's a name, it's an important name in what we do, but it's not a name that you're going to hear a lot.
Right.
So 1973, Gygax and Arneson collaborate on drafts of Dungeons & Dragons. Gygax and Kay form a partnership called Tactical Studies Rules. Brian Bloom joins Tactical Study Rules to help produce the Dungeons & Dragons game. 1974. This is a year that we all know. This is the year, the first time that Dungeons & Dragons is published, and it's published in January as three booklets, shipping in a wood grain-colored cardboard box, Men & Magic, Monsters & Treasures, and Underworld & Wilderness Adventures. Within 11 months, the entire hand-assembled print run of 1,000 games sells out. So in the first year, they moved about 1,000 units.
Which, for the mid-70s, isn't bad.
Yeah, because our hobby didn't exist.
Right.
I mean, you had wargamers, but our hobby, as we know it today, did not exist. And this was the start of that. So, 1975, Tactical Studies Rules dissolves and a new company forms, TSR Hobbies Incorporated. A second 1,000-set printing of Dungeons & Dragons sells out in just under 6 months, quickly followed by a third printing of 2,000, all sold before the new year. So now their 1,000 in a year became 3,000 in 2 years.
Right.
So the Dungeons & Dragons supplement Greyhawk specifies the Thief and Paladin classes. Its sequel, Blackmoor, introduces the Monk and the Assassin. How do we explain to people out there that haven't been around for a long time, that haven't played the early stuff, you didn't have a race and a class, per se, like you do now with most games?
Correct.
If you wanted to be an elf, that was your class. It wasn't your race. I think dwarf was the same way.
Right. It was primarily elf and dwarf. If you wanted to be something that was what we would nowadays consider a class, you had to be human.
Right.
Because the dwarf and the elf kind of built into their cultural background and the pluses and minuses for being that type of character had certain elements of what we would now associate with a class already built in.
Correct. So then in that same year, 1975, Origins 1. So we all know about the Origins game convention.
Right.
The first one was 1975. It hosts the first major Dungeons & Dragons convention tournament, later to be published as Adventure Module S1. Do you know what that is?
No.
Tomb of Horrors. Which I'm sure you've played through by this time in your life.
Actually, I have not.
I happen to own it, so we might have to make that happen.
Okay.
Because I've run through it as a player two or three times, so to run it might be fun. I've never ran it. All right, and TSR Hobbies sponsors Gen Con for the first time. Now, Lake Geneva Con becomes Gen Con.
Yes, so we're now 74 or 75?
This is 75. So we are right now. Yeah, we're eight. Is it eight from the first one?
67.
68 was the first Lake Geneva War Game Convention, which I believe they also called Gen Con Zero, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
I could be wrong on that, but anyway. So, but now they've become a sponsor for this convention that's growing. So 1976, this is a good year, and I say that because that was the year I was born. For a fourth printing of 5,000 copies, Dungeons & Dragons switches to the white box that will be used for future printings of the original game. The first professional magazine devoted to fantasy and science fiction gaming is published, The Dragon, which begins bi-monthly publications in June. And then also D&D Supplements 3 and 4, Eldritch Wizardry, and Gods, Demigods, and Heroes are introduced. Gods and Demigods and Heroes, it's went through name changes throughout the years, but that's one of my favorite books.
Now, is that the one that became Deities and Demigods?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It is. So, and then, so that's 1976. The Dragon is a big thing. It no longer exists now, except digitally.
Right.
And they don't make new issues. But I have found some, over the years, some really cool stuff in Dragon Magazine. So.
Right. And in Dragon Magazine, not only did you have some errata, rules clarifications, maybe some expansion ideas that they wanted to get some feedback from their core audience before investing in publishing it. But you also start to see with Dragon the advent of not only fantasy fan fiction, but a not just a genre fan fiction, but a specific item fan fiction, or a specific, I can't think of the word I want to use, but it's not genre, it's not subgenre, but it's specifically Dungeons and Dragons world setting fan fiction.
Right. You will have fan fiction that is in, well, at this point it would be Greyhawk or Blackmoor, because that's all that existed at this point.
Right.
But as the magazine went on, it would be Forgotten Realms. It would be the other cool thing that they did with Dragon is they would introduce magical items that you wouldn't find in any of the other books. They would introduce I always call them mini campaigns, like a 3 or 4 page, you know, sit down one night and play this game.
Right. Kind of a handy one shot guide or outline for maybe you have someone who is been a player and they're like, I want to try my hand at running.
Right.
But I don't know how to do all the prep work. Well, here's a little quick one shot that you can sit down, read through in about an hour, and then run in 4 with your buddies that night.
Yeah. One of my favorite things I ever found in a Dungeon magazine, or I'm sorry, a Dragon magazine, because there is a Dungeon magazine later on. But in Dragon magazine there was a column where you rolled a percentile, and that would give your either your NPC or your player characters a quirk or a personality trait that, you know, just helped to flush out the character.
Yes.
They were silly and stuff, but when I ran a lot of second ed, I used it all the time. Because it was just, to me, I've always been a character builder. So to me, it was always, this gives us one more thing you can work with. You know, some of them we would roll and we're like, maybe not. That would really disrupt the game. So you'd re-roll or I would give you one. But just a little quirk that would just make something a little more fun. And that's what Dragon was really there for. I mean, there was a lot of good information in there. There was a lot of good artwork in there. This is sounding more and more like Playboy. Good pictures, good articles. But anyway.
Yeah. Although you bring up an interesting point when you were describing how you used it.
Mm-hmm.
In that if you rolled something that you or the other players didn't like or felt would be disruptive, you were free to disregard it and go with something else.
Well,
a lot of people, when they think about games and they think about rules, they have this concept that this is what the rule says, therefore we cannot change it. And that was it's now a core principle of all role-playing games. But that was something that was actually the case in wargaming.
Oh, yeah.
That when you transitioned from the original wargaming into this new format, became a possibility of bending the rules or even throwing the rules out the window if doing it a different way meant you had more fun.
Right. And, you know, it's one of those things that if it's going to totally throw your game off the rails, why do it?
Exactly.
I mean, we've all run campaigns that have gone afoul, I'm sure. I know one time I said, you know what? I don't care what world it comes from. If it's a die 20 game, make a character, bring it to the table. It was a horrendous train wreck. But how did I know that? Because I did it.
Right.
If I had never done it, in the back of my head, it would still sound like this really perfect, cool kind of thing to do. But I said, hey, there's six of you. Go. Be free. Use whatever die 20 rule set you want. Bring it back. We'll figure it out. And we did. We played for 6 weeks, maybe. And by the end of the 6 weeks, we were all just kind of like, I don't think this is working. So we did something else. But anyway, let's move on. 1977, Dungeons & Dragons is divided into basic and advanced versions. The D&D basic set, edited by J. Eric Holmes, became the first Dungeons & Dragons box set to be shipped with dice included. I suppose that's something else we can talk about. The dice you use in role-playing.
Don't you just use those regular cubes like they use in Vegas at the craps table?
No. Well, you do, but that's only one of the... Well, the base set is seven dice.
Okay.
You have a four-sided die, okay, or as we all like to call it, the caltrops.
Yes.
You have your six-sided die, which is like what you use in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
You have your eight-sided die, which is two caltrops put together. Then you have your ten-sided die, which is... Well, it's ten-sided. You got five on top, five on the bottom. Not as pointy as the 4 or 8-point dice. And then they call it a percentile, which is where you've got a 10-sided die that has 0 through 90, which gives you your 10s, and then you have your singles. Then you have a 12-sided die and a 20-sided die, the polyhedral,
yes,
the dice that is worshipped by everybody. And there have been games that have used 30-sided dice, and I think even a 50-sided dice I've seen in my life. But for the most part, 4 to 20 is what is really what you use. Also in 77, TSR Hobbies publishes the Monster Manual, the first book in the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons product line. Its 350 monsters exert a huge influence over subsequent fantasy gaming, both on the tabletop and computers. 1978, The Player's Handbook, the second Advanced Dungeons & Dragons hardcover, is released. So, there's another thing. Nowadays, we think about role-playing games, everything's hardcover. Well, except some of the supplements.
Right.
But all the core books are hardcovered. And it's kind of strange when you see a player's handbook that's soft cover. You know, they release them with certain sets. But it's not the full book either. I don't know if you've got one of those, the soft covers.
I have a 3.5 soft cover. And my brother-in-law actually just bought a hardcover 3.5. So I'm going to snag his and flip through it and see what the differences are.
There's not a lot missing, but there is some content missing in those.
Mm-hmm.
So the Dragon magazine then moves to a monthly publication as of April of 1978. TSR Hobbies produces a series of six adventure modules that were used for convention tournaments, beginning with the Origins tournament combating Hill, Frost, and Fire Giants, so G1 through 3, and then the Gen Con tournament exploring an underworld of Kuatoa and Drow elves, so D1 to D3. Kuatoa, what are they? Do you know?
Those are the ones who worship...
that would be correct.
The underwater evil goddess. They're kind of like humanoid frogs,
yeah,
almost.
Yeah, fish frogs. Depends on which version.
Right.
But yes, they're an evil race of underwater dwellers. And then the drow elves are just an evil race of elves that live underground.
Yes. So now, I want to go back to one of the things you mentioned about dragon.
Okay.
It had been bi-monthly, meaning it produced an issue every 2 months. It's now gone to monthly. On the face of it, that doesn't seem like very much, but think of it. They have doubled their production volume in, I think, less than a decade that they've been in operation.
Yeah, yeah.
So that just speaks to the explosion of interest in this new game and this new type of game that... there's at least twice as much material available for them to publish.
Right, right. And the fact that they've got a big enough audience buying this every month that they can pay for that, and I wouldn't hold it against them if they were making some money off of it, because that's kind of why you go into business.
Right.
So, in also 1978, Gen Con leaves Lake Geneva for the University of Wisconsin Parkside campus, where it remains for the next 7 years. So that's in 1978. 1979, TSR Hobbies releases the Dungeon Master's Guide, the third and final core Advanced Dungeons & Dragons hardcover rulebook. Shortages in the supply chain lead to some copies of the basic set shipping with the cardboard chit sheet instead of dice. So they ran out of dice.
Okay.
So in I guess to make up for it, they sent out these chits. Now, I've never seen a set of the original chits, but I can imagine people buying it and getting chits and not dice would be... Well, I bet you the chit hit the fan.
Most likely, yes.
All right, 1980. Around 250,000 units of Dungeons & Dragons products were sold prior to the beginning of the year. By summer, sales of the basic set alone reached 12,000 copies per month. So just not even 15 years earlier, they sold 1,000 copies. They're now up to 12,000 per month.
Yes.
So to meet growing international demand, TSR Hobbies UK Limited is formed in England. The initial release of the World of Greyhawk folder marks the first campaign setting produced by TSR, providing a context for the action and modules which harkens back to the original Great Kingdom of the Castles and Crusade Society. So a lot of this stuff from Wargaming is coming full circle and becoming part of what we do.
Right.
Greyhawk is still a setting in D&D, and probably will be as long as D&D exists.
I would imagine. It's a foundation piece for the game. It's something that you and I discussed. I've never played a module set in the Greyhawk setting, and I've never been in a campaign where the DM was running Greyhawk. However, as soon as you say Greyhawk, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly. And everybody that, I mean, whether you played in Greyhawk or not, and I probably have a time or two at a convention, it's medieval England.
Right.
You know, that's just what it is. So also in 1980, TSR Hobbies unveils the Deities and Demigods Cyclopedia for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. So, just out of curiosity, you're a little bit older than me. I got into the hobby late. Do you remember what year you started playing in?
Yes. My first experience with D&D was almost my last.
Okay.
My senior year of high school, so this is 87, 88.
Okay.
I happened to swing by a chess club meeting at my high school because I'd always been a fan of chess, but okay. I never had the time to be part of chess club. And so it just so happened that I had this one afternoon free, and I swung by, and three of the guys were waiting for everybody else to show up so they could start the meeting and play, and they had out a copy of what I later discovered was second edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons.
Okay.
And they had a regular ongoing campaign that they did, and they said, well, hey, pull up a chair, we'll roll you up a character, and for as long as you can hang out, you can play, and then if you ever have time to come back, we'll get you in again.
Okay.
And at the time, they were using the characteristic generation rule of roll 3d6, and that's what you get.
Straight down.
Straight down. And for whatever reason that the stars or gravity or the fixed dice were in alignment, I rolled 6 18s.
Oh.
Which statistically is amazingly unusual.
I'm not going to say impossible, but I will say improbable.
Yes.
I mean, to see a character sheet most of the time with 2 18s on it, chances are part of that is going to be race adjustment.
Correct.
So just to let you people out there, if you're not D&D people, realize how rare something like that would be.
Yes. And after I rolled my sixth one, they said, you're too lucky, go away. So I never actually got to play.
Okay.
So fast forward to the following year, I'm a freshman in college, and I'm talking to a couple of guys that I had met in my organic chemistry class. And they said, yeah, we've got a few of us that are gaming. Why don't you stop on by? And I'm like, okay. I love fantasy and sci-fi fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounded kind of interesting. They described it to me as kind of a cooperative storytelling setup with some dice-based combat. I'm like, okay, sounds good. But we were playing Champions, which at the time was it's a superhero role-playing game at the time published by Iron Crown Enterprises.
Okay.
I didn't actually do anything with Dungeons & Dragons until my sophomore year, I want to say.
Okay.
So that's 89 to 90.
Okay. I even came in a little bit later than that. I started playing in 1994, basically because my mother never allowed me to. I had friends that played in school and stuff, and it always sounded really cool to me. And I shouldn't say that I never played. I had played once before that. I went to a friend's house, and we went in the basement, and we played El Cadium, which was the genies in the desert and that kind of a setting. And I went home, and I was excited about it because I had a blast doing it. And my mom's like, D&D, you're going to hell, kind of thing, you know. And
which is something I'll talk about a little later.
I'm sure you will. So anyway, so we get into 1981. Tom Moldavay revises the basic set, and David Zeb Cook produces a sequel, Expert Set, The Isle of Dread. The module shipping with the Expert Set introduces the campaign world of Mystara. The Fiend Folio tome for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons highlights creatures submitted to the pages of White Dwarf magazine. The Role-Playing Game Association, the RPGA, is formed to promote quality role-playing and unite gamers across the nation, aided by its flagship Polyhedron magazine. Have you ever seen a Polyhedron magazine?
I have not.
I haven't either.
I actually had a little bit of a negative experience with the RPGA.
A lot of people do, unfortunately. Yeah, a lot of people do, unfortunately. I have never dealt directly with the RPGA, even when I had my shop. We just stayed away from them because everything we ever heard was they're difficult to work with. They can be quite elitist at times, and so it doesn't surprise me that that you had that problem. But so let's move on. 1982, TSR releases its first video game products, including a version of The Dungeon board game for the Apple II computer system. Now a cultural icon, Dungeons & Dragons appears in numerous mainstream media, even inspiring a scene in the film E.T. Do you remember that in E.T. where they're sitting around the table playing D&D?
Yep.
And the little girl's trying to get involved, and they're just like, get out of here. Girls don't play this, blah, 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 you know. So, 1983, TSR Hobbies reorganizes into TSR Inc. TSR releases the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual 2. Frank Menzner begins the three-year process of revising and expanding basic D&D with new versions of the basic and expert set. Now, we've both met Frank.
Yes.
Frank is, he's a nice guy, but he's a little, he almost seems caught up in himself, in what he is.
A little bit. He's, I think part of it is an artifact, and this affects many, many people. Actually, you see it a lot of times in actors, especially, who had huge success early, and then nothing they did afterwards kind of measured up to that.
Okay.
And so that it's kind of similar to what people jokingly refer to as the high school quarterback who never got out of the big game, that they view themselves through the lens of that part of their life. And so everything that they do from then on is related or connected back to that pivotal moment.
Right. And I mean, for good reason. He had a big footprint in that crossover from the original basic into second edition kind of stuff. And what Frank has brought to the table as far as, you know, his what he gave to the games we play is, without Frank, you know, where would we be? We don't know.
Right.
Would somebody have else stepped in there and done it? Most likely. Would they have done it the same? Probably not. So, also in 83, a new subsidiary, the Dungeons & Dragons Entertainment Company, premieres its Dungeons & Dragons cartoon series on September 17th. This series spawns more than 100 different licenses and enjoys a positive reception. Now, I'm going to step back here, because when we first started talking about this, we were going to talk about the Dungeons & Dragons cartoon.
Right.
And then the more we talked about it, we went, maybe we need to actually talk about the cultural impact of the cartoon. And now we're just talking about D&D in general. And I'm hoping you're going to bring up something on the cartoon more
yes.
than this. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. And then also in 1983, French is the first foreign language adaptation of the D&D game, and many other translations follow. Danish, Finnish, German, Hebrew, Italian, Japanese, Korean, Norwegian, Swedish, and there are more. I think it's up to, I want to say 22 or 24 different languages now that D&D is printed in.
Probably.
And in my research, I did notice that up in those Nordic countries, they haven't really left second edition. That's pretty much all that's played up there. So if you're ever looking to get rid of your second ed stuff, throw it online, make sure they can see it in Norway and Sweden, and you're probably going to sell it. All right, 1984. The companion set continues Menser's revision of basic D&D. For the 10th anniversary of Dungeons & Dragons, TSR publishes a collector's box set including the basic, expert, and companion set rules, along with modules and character sheets. TSR Inc. releases the first novel in the Dragonlance saga after 2 years of development. Dragonlance makes TSR the number one publisher of fantasy and science fiction novels in the nation. That's kind of shocking to me.
Well, if you think about it, this is early to mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
We have very little major fantasy literature, at least in English, going around. I mean, everybody assumes that because The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings were written back in the early part of the 20th century, that fantasy literature has always been huge. It really hasn't. In fact, the resurgence of interest in Hobbit and Lord of the Rings and the green lighting of Peter Jackson's movies has really owed a certain amount to the surge of interest generated by D&D.
Oh, I believe it. But there was a lot of sci-fi going on at that point, though.
Yes, fueled largely by some of the utopian or dystopian TV shows and movies from the 60s, like Star Trek, 2001, A Space Odyssey, Lost in Space. Science fiction got a huge boost from the space race between America and the Soviet Union.
Right.
Nobody was really researching how to breed dragons.
Yeah, no, I agree, absolutely. So we move into 1985. The new hardbound AD&D titles, On Earth Arcana and Oriental Adventures, are released. Former Deities and Demigods is retitled Legends and Lore for a reissue. TSR publishes Menser's Master Set for high-level adventuring based on basic D&D. And also in 1985, Gen Con relocates to Milwaukee, where it will stay through 2002. Now, I know you went to Gen Con when it was in Milwaukee.
Yes.
I never went there when it was in Milwaukee. I never went till it went to Indianapolis. So, to keep in the thought of time here, give us your best Milwaukee Gen Con story.
Milwaukee Gen Con, for me, I had an absolute blast.
Okay.
I don't believe I actually played a single D&D game.
Okay.
Because at this point in time, I still wasn't all that big into D&D. I mean, my friends and I played it. It was one of our campaigns, but we were also playing Champions. We were also playing Rifts. We dabbled a little bit in GURPS when it first came out.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Generic Universal Role-Playing System. Yeah. Some people like it. GURPS is one of those you either love it or you hate it. And I'm sorry, one of the haters. But my favorite Gen Con in Milwaukee was a Champions game, and it was a villain game. We were playing the module called Clown, Criminal Legion of Wacky Nonconformists.
Okay.
And the character I was playing was named Buford the Bard.
Okay.
His shtick was he had been a Shakespearean actor, and he suffered a traumatic brain injury that resulted in him thinking he, to a certain extent, that he was Shakespeare. And so his character quirk was that whenever possible, everything he said had to sound like it came from a Shakespearean play.
Okay.
For me, this was probably less of a challenge than for other people because I was working towards a degree in theater. I had done several Shakespeare productions already. And so I really got into the character. And at the time, Gen Con gave every game master or every judge for the games a $5 gift certificate to the bazaar to be handed out to whomever the game master thought was the best role player at the game.
Okay.
And I won for that session because I got into character. I stayed in everything I did was either in iambic pentameter or sounded like a Shakespearean soliloquy.
Okay.
And all of that. So, and I had a lot of fun with it. And it was really laid back. There were a couple of sessions or a couple of times where I had 2 or 3 hours to kill. And I'd walk through the hallways and around, and this was kind of around the time that Magic the Gathering, the collectible card game, was starting to come out, and people had brought their decks, and I had brought my deck. And so every so often I'd be like, hey, there's 5 of you. If I sit in, do we want to do a 3-on-3 Emperor? And they're like, okay, yeah, sure. And so we're just sitting in a hallway playing Magic while we're waiting to go play a role-playing game.
Okay. Awesome. So 1986. TSR introduces Dungeon Adventure magazines, an all-adventure bi-monthly. The Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Dungeoneer's Survival Guide and Wilderness Survival Guide are published. And then also for the Ultimate Adventuring and Basic D&D, Menzner finishes his expansions with the Immortals set. 1987, the Immense Forgotten Realms campaign setting is released. It will be the setting of numerous modules, novels, and computer games. Forgotten Realms, that is my D&D world. That is the one that I will go back to a lot. It is also the one that I have modeled my own world after. I just love Forgotten Realms. But anyway, TSR publishes the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Manual of the Planes, and a small team of designers start work on the second edition of the AD&D game. So 1988... Strategic Simulations Incorporated releases the personal computer game Pool of Radiance, the first licensed computer adaptation of the AD&D system, and the first computer game set in the Forgotten Realms campaign setting. A number of Goldbox games based on the same AD&D engine follow. 1989. Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition is released, under lead designer David Zeb Cook. Releases for 2nd Edition include the Dungeon Master's Guide, the Player's Handbook, Monstrous Compendiums Volumes 1, 2, and 3, Complete Fighter's Handbook, and Complete Thieves Handbook. And I'm going to bring this one up because I know you've got a story about this. There was one also called the Complete Bards.
Yes, they had the Complete Handbook series covered pretty much all of the available character classes. I mean, you not only had fighter, thief, but you had wizards, priests, bard. I think there was a paladin. There was a ranger. So the one I loved was the Complete Bard's Handbook. And that was for a couple of reasons. One was that it had, and the Complete Handbooks introduced specialized classes, where you weren't just a fighter, you could be like a sellsword or a guard. It offered further specialization options. With they also had the racial handbooks, dwarf and elf. One of the things I loved about the bard was that it had a range of bard classes, like bard specializations, but then it also had a specialization for each of the 4 non-human races. You had the Dwarven Skald, who is basically a battle priest and mining supervisor. He would use his music to help the miners be more productive and stay on task and everything.
Okay.
You had the Elven Spellsinger, which was kind of a throwback to the original elf class from the first one. You had the Halfling Whistler, but my favorite was the Gnome Professor.
Why, Scott, was the Gnome Professor your favorite?
The Gnome Professor was a tinkerer. And a lot of the... If you played 2nd edition D&D and even into 3.5, gnomes who use magic are almost exclusively illusionists. For a while, it was actually required that if you were a gnome mage, you were an illusionist specialist. You didn't have an option of being, say, an evoker or a necromancer. You were an illusionist. The Gnome Professor class still incorporated that. You had some of the magic that a bard generally has, But you are also a technologist. You invented things. You figured out how things worked. And so that always appealed to the problem-solving side of me. But probably my absolute favorite in the Complete Bard's Handbook was the Riddle Master.
Okay.
And the Riddle Master was, I mean, to me, he seemed like the ultimate know-it-all who actually had enough to back up most of his position.
So he had a little bit more than, say, just bardic knowledge?
Right. He was the puzzle solver. He was the one who figured out the underpinnings of everything. And due to a typo in the original production of the Bard's Handbook, in the second edition D&D, when you had figured your strength, it had a few secondary attributes. One of them was bend bars and lift gates, which basically represented your ability to do the... If you've ever seen the Street Fighter movie, yay, you're one of the five of us who have. But there's a scene at the end where Zangief, the Russian strongman, is holding up the ceiling as the mountain is collapsing and everybody is escaping. Basically, the bend bars lift gates represented your ability to like walk up to a door or a portcullis or something and do a Hulk move on it and just throw it up regardless of how it's fastened down. And it was expressed as a percentage. The Bard's Handbook for the Riddle Master had the typo that you had a bonus to bend bards. And it was a 5% bonus. And so I was playing a Riddle Master one time, and we were in this campaign, and we needed to get some information from this other NPC bard. And I told the DM, kind of tongue-in-cheek, well, I want to try to bend him a little. And he's like, what do you mean? So I brought out the Bard's Handbook, and it says right here, I have a 5% chance to bend bards. And he's like, okay, I'll allow it. And I made it. So I and so I bent him a little, kind of like what you hear them refer to in like old gangster movies. I'm going to lean on him a little. I'm going to bend him a little, make him talk.
All right. So also in 1989, I have nothing to say about that other than it's funny. I mean, but also in 1989, the RPGA network branches out into Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and the UK, Israel, and Australia. So that brings us into the 90s. 1990, my second favorite campaign setting is released, and that would be Ravenloft.
I love Ravenloft.
Featuring Count Strahd von Zarovich, one of the most popular enduring villains of the AD&D game. That's because you can't kill him. But anyway, TSR publishes the Hollow World campaign set. Dragonlance comes to the computer in the SSI Gold Box title, Champions of Kryn. 1991, TSR releases the Dungeons & Dragons Rules Cyclopedia, designed by Aaron Alston, integrating systems from the basic expert, companion, and master set rules. So it showed you how to work these rule sets together is what I'm understanding. I've never actually done anything with the Rules Cyclopedia, but that's what I would assume they do.
Right. I've seen it, and this is kind of Aaron Alston's forte. He also worked for Hero Games when they bought Champions from Iron Crown Enterprises. Okay. And he has written multiple supplements for Hero System line, Champions, Fantasy Hero, Star Hero, Pulp Hero, etc.
Okay.
And a lot of them focused on either introducing new rules or cleaning up errata from previous editions.
Okay. Neverwinter Nights online graphical multiplayer role-playing game begins on the AOL network in collaboration with SSI, Stormfront, and TSR. Neverwinter Nights, now I never played the online one, but the actual computer game was hard. It was not easy. And the Savage World of Athas features in the new Dark Sun campaign setting. And then an introductory Dungeons & Dragons game produced by Troy Denning and Tim Brown aims to attract beginners to the game. One of the best things they ever did, they do it to this day. You can go out and you can buy a introductory rule set, and it comes in a box set. It gives you all the tokens you need. It gives you an adventure. It gives you a slimlined version of the player's handbook. And it gives you everything you need to test it, to see if it's what you want to do.
Right, because nowadays, I mean, the hardcover rule book, if you buy it full list, you're sinking $50 into it. And
some
that's
of them are
one,
60, yeah.
That's one book. These box sets, and you're right, it's slimmed down. It gets rid of a lot of the specialization elements. And like we've talked about before, you don't necessarily need all the rules or to be slavishly devoted to all of the rules to have fun with it. This was something that, hey, you buy this, you try it out. If you like it, then you investigate, okay, how do I do more with this?
Right. And they're relatively cheap. I think the last one, like $25.
Right.
You know, it's an investment, but it's not a, you know, it's not a $150 investment.
Correct.
So, 1992, the first El Kadiem campaign setting produced product is released, Arabian Adventures. TSR's first hardcover novel is published, The Legacy by R.A. Salvatore, which debuts in the top 10 of the New York Times bestseller list. And the 25th anniversary of Gen Con, co-located with Origins, breaks all previous attendance records for any U.S. gaming convention. 1993, the early Monstrous Compendiums are repackaged as the hardcover Monstrous Manual Tome. So what they did is the original Monstrous Compendiums, there were three of them, they came punched to go in a three-ring binder.
Yep.
And if you wanted to spend the extra few dollars, you could actually get the big three-ring binder that said Monstrous Compendium on it.
Yes.
And also 93, the release of the Dragon Strike Entertainment product, which includes a 30-minute video dramatizing a unique perspective on tabletop role-playing. 1994, in response to the success of trading card games, TSR publishes Spellfire, Master the Magic, a trading card game featuring the well-known names and settings of the AD&D game. The dark and rich Planescape campaign setting is introduced, and the first TSR game products incorporating an audio compact disc are released. So they released music to go with the game.
Yep. And I actually played Spellfire briefly.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
Okay. 1995, TSR marks the 20th anniversary with revised versions of the 2nd Edition Player's Handbook and Dungeon Master's Guide. Experienced 2nd Edition fans find new ideas in the Player's Option and Dungeon Master's Option rulebooks, i.e. the Black Books.
Right.
Which a lot of us call 2.75, because it was that transition between what 2nd, or what would become 3rd Ed.
Right.
So the Birthright campaign setting introduces blood magic, the power of the land, and the divine rights of kings. 1996, TSR sells a digital version of its Dungeons & Dragons rules for the first time, the AD&D Core Rules CD-ROM. The Wizard Spell Compendiums, a new book series, is launched, compiling all wizard spells in the 4 volumes, which are sitting right over there. Because I don't play a magic user a whole lot, but as I can pick up second ed stuff, I do it just because it's like to have it available. So if I ever get around to running a second ed game again, I'll have these things for the people like Jeremiah,
right,
who want to play a wizard. So, and then the Dragonlance 5th Age role-playing game is released, bringing the popular setting to the card-based Saga system. So 1997, a new era in gaming commences as Wizards of the Coast purchases TSR in June. That was a sad time for a lot of us when TSR went away.
Right, because we had that nostalgic attachment to it. And especially like me, I'm from Boston, but I've lived in Wisconsin pretty much since I came here for college in 88.
Mm-hmm.
So more, I've spent more of my life living in Wisconsin than I have living anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You're born and raised in,
yep,
Wisconsin.
Sure am.
And TSR originated in Lake Geneva. D&D is Wisconsin.
Absolutely. So it was a hard time for some of us. And I know a lot of us for a while were just like, we're not going to deal with that Wizards of the Coast. It's not going to be D&D. And I played 2nd Edition. I didn't actually play 3.0. I didn't get in until 3.5. Which, from what I've seen in retrospect, it was probably a good choice.
Yes.
Because there was a lot of problems with 3.0, but anyway.
Which is why they released 3.5.
Right. So, 1998, Wizards resurrects the Greyhawk setting for the Return of the Eight. And then Baldur's Gate, the first computer game in the Forgotten Realms developed by BioWare, is released. The Infinity Engine used for Baldur's Gate would serve as the basis for several other second edition AD&D computer adaptations. 1999. Wizards celebrates the 25th birthday of Dungeons & Dragons with a silver anniversary tour of game stores throughout the United States, as well as the release of the Silver Anniversary Retrospective Box Set of Dungeons & Dragons. And the acclaimed Planescape Torment brings the Planescape setting to computer games. And then in 2000, the third edition Dungeons & Dragons is released by Wizards of the Coast. Under the core design team of Jonathan Tweet, Monty Cook, and Skip Williams, with new revisions of the Player's Handbook, Dungeon Master's Guide, and Monster Manual, Wizards no longer refers to these flagship releases as Advanced D&D. With the initial publication of the Open Game License and the first system reference document, the industry is transformed by opportunities for third-party products based on the 3rd edition D&D rules. A feature film based on D&D appears in theaters, starring Jeremy Irons and including a cameo appearance as the magic user by game co-creator Dave Arneson. I think we have to talk about the D&D movie.
Yes, and
do you have some of that later?
I have. Well, we can do it now. Actually, okay. That's fine because everybody had high hopes for the movie. And if you think about it, okay, D&D has just gone to 3.0. It has a lot of money behind it with Wizards of the Coast, which some people may recognize as the producer of Magic the Gathering collectible card game, which is how they got the money to buy TSR.
Right, right.
So as the main bad guy, they cast Jeremy Irons. Major talent, major Hollywood actor. And I recently ran across a list in a book of actors who appeared in famously bad movies. And his quote, when they asked him, why did you do this movie? He said, well, I just bought a castle and I got to pay for it somehow. But you have Jeremy Irons. You have Justin Whalen, a young up-and-coming actor. He'd done Charles in Charge. Probably best known for his role as Jimmy Olsen in Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman with Dean Cain and Terry Hatcher. His big break was actually he was the title character in the feature film The Little Prince.
Okay, okay.
So he's got some solid acting chops behind him.
And probably the best given performance in that movie.
Right. He's the plucky hero. So then you have Marlon Wayans. Okay, one of the Wayans brothers, very proficient physical comedy actor.
Mm-hmm.
Not somebody you're going to cast in a Shakespearean tragedy, but his character was a goofball, and he plays a goofball really well.
Yeah, yeah. Snails was an endearing character
mm-hmm.
that did nothing for the story.
Right. Unfortunately, a lot of the characters did nothing for the story.
Yes, yes.
But you had, with the female characters, you had Thora Birch and Zoe McClellan. And you think about, okay, they've done amazing stuff. They really didn't do so well in the film.
No, no.
But then one of the things I thought was very interesting was I'm going through the list of actors. Richard O'Brien from Rocky Horror Picture Show played Riff Raff. He's in it.
Yeah, he plays the Thief Guild, the head of the Thieves Guild.
The Guild Master.
Yeah.
And then, for all of you Doctor Who fans, Tom Baker is in the movie.
Do you remember what role he played?
Not really. It didn't... IMDb had some information about it, but he was further down the line,
okay,
so he was
okay.
Kind of an incidental character. But theoretically, the story premise was good. You've got this excellent cast. I don't know what happened when they wrote it.
Honestly, I think the problem came in with whoever the director was. I think it was directed by a high school student.
Yeah, or at least they had a high school student as the acting coach.
Yeah.
Because I remember the one scene where they teleport in and the wizard who's casting teleport gets her arm stuck in a block in the wall because she miscasts it.
Right.
And it's like they appear... You kind of see her arm, and then the special effects cuts in. And then you can almost see when she hears the director yell, pain, because then all of a sudden she collapses and screams.
Right, right.
So.
And there's nothing, I'm not saying anything bad about high school actors. Learn your craft. You got to start somewhere. But when you're doing a major motion picture, and this was a major motion picture, high school acting is not what you want to see.
Correct.
So anyway, also in 2000, Gary Gygax guest stars in the Anthology of Interest episode of Futurama, wherein he plays D&D with Al Gore, Stephen Hawking, and others. I may have to go find this episode because I don't watch Futurama, but that sounds amazing.
Yes.
2001, the Dungeons & Dragons Chainmail Miniatures game is released in October, bringing gameplay back to its roots in fantastic medieval wargaming. If they say so. School of Radiance computer game series returns with the Runes of Mythdranor, produced by Ubisoft. 2002, Gen Con is purchased by the Wizards founder and former CEO, Peter Atkinson, who the following year would move to the convention to its current home in Indianapolis. Which I think last year they just signed an agreement with the city now through 2020, I want to say.
That sounds right. It's, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that later, but
okay.
This is big money.
Oh, yeah. BioWare releases a new Neverwinter Nights computer game, which includes an internet-based multiplayer mode. The system is based on 3rd edition D&D, and the campaign is set in the Forgotten Realms. Best-selling novels continue to emerge from the Dragonlance and Forgotten Realms setting, including this year's Dragons of a Vanished Moon, The War of Souls, Volume 3, and The Thousand Orcs, both of which debut on the New York Times bestsellers list. 2003, a revision to the 3rd edition D&D, known as version 3.5, appears in new versions on the core rulebooks. And that's when I got into 3rd edition. I actually, long story short, I had collected these collectible cards for a game called Assassins, I want to say it was called, or something like that. And I had two complete sets. Nobody I knew played anymore. I traded the guy at the game store both of my sets of that card game for a core set of books.
Okay.
That's how I got into 3.5. The classic super module, The Temple of Elemental Evil, set in the Greyhawk, jumps to computer games in a version developed by Troika Games. And the Dungeons & Dragons miniatures game debuts with the first in a series of collectible miniatures for tactical combat based on D&D. 2004, Wizards releases the worst campaign setting ever, Eberron, which had won their 2002 contest to design a new campaign setting for Dungeons & Dragons. Personal thing, I don't think robots belong in D&D. And that's all Warforged were. They were just robots.
Pretty much.
30th anniversary of Dungeons & Dragons is honored with a retrospective book on the game's history, 30 Years of Adventure. A new Dungeons & Dragons basic game is released, designed by Jonathan Tweet, and the first worldwide Dungeons & Dragons game day is held October 16th. 2005, Three Dragon Ante, a non-collectible Wizards card game, provides a system for incorporating its use in the play of Dungeons & Dragons. Now, if you look at the rules, they do talk about this game that was played called Three Dragon Ante, which is basically three card ante.
Right.
Just with really fancy cards. 2006, the massively multiplayer online role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons Online is released by Turbine Entertainment. Wizards holds a Dungeons & Dragons fan film contest. Obsidian Entertainment releases Neverwinter Nights 2, a sequel to the prior BioWare title, which incorporates Dungeons & Dragons Edition 3.5 rules. 2007, 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons is announced at Gen Con. So we got version 3.5 in 2003.
Yes.
We got version 3 in 99.
Mm-hmm.
And by 2007, we're in the 4th edition. Well, actually, 2008, before it actually comes out, but Wizards launched D&D Insider, an online subscription service that provides character and adventure management tools. Read a book. The Dungeons & Dragons Adventure Magazine relaunch as online publications for D&D Insider subscribers. And the traditional Winter Fantasy Convention is renamed the D&D Experience up to 2013. 2008, Wizards publishes the core 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons sourcebooks under lead designer Rob Hensu, a player's handbook, dungeon master's guide, monster manual, and also a new adventures vault containing equipment and treasure. Okay, I need to talk a little bit about 4th edition. 4th edition was not a bad game in and of itself. Its rules were very easy to follow.
Yes.
But it was too much like a video game for me, because once you picked your class and your race, you followed a tree, which split very rarely. There was no cross-classing.
Correct.
There was no really way to make a different thief. You made a thief.
Mm-hmm.
And just like a tree on a video game, you might get two or maybe three choices. But unlike a video game, you can't get those other choices down the line because you've now went to the next level.
Right.
So that was my big thing with 4th edition. It didn't feel like Dungeons & Dragons to me. It felt more like World of Warcraft Online. So, I don't know, did you deal with 4th edition at all?
Very briefly, and for much the same reason, I didn't care for it. However, I had friends who had never done D&D or were more of the video game style, and when they had seen either a D&D 2nd edition or 3.5, they said, this is too complex, you're spending too much time reading the rules and figuring things out.
It can be very overwhelming.
Yes, and so they loved 4th because it was very streamlined.
Yeah, that's exactly why Nikki liked it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, also in 2008, release of the game system license enables third-party producers to produce 4th edition compatible products. And the Dungeons & Dragons miniature game rules changed to permit use with the 4th edition D&D. And it killed the earlier game because there was no way to convert.
Correct.
At least not easily. So if you had a lot of those 3rd edition
miniatures,
I do. I was going to say, raise your hand if you do, Scott.
Yep.
4th edition was a waste of your time.
Mm-hmm.
So, 2009, 4th edition expands on its core rule books with sequels, The Player's Handbook 2, Dungeon Master's Guide 2, Monster Manual 2, and Adventurer's Vault 2. And select articles from The Dragon are compiled into a hardcover annual. 2010, the Dungeons & Dragons Essential product line offers a streamlined rendition of the rules through its introductory starter set, as well as the Dungeon Master's Kit, Rules Compendium, and Monsters Vault. First season of Organized Play D&D Encounters series of adventures begins in March with Undermountain, Hallister's Lost Apprentice, and the release of Dungeons & Dragons Castle Ravenloft board game launches a series of Dungeons & Dragons Adventure System cooperative board games. Those I enjoyed. I actually had the Ravenloft game, and I had another one of them. I have since sold them because they were really hard to set up, and it was one of those games where you just died all the time.
Right. Well, it's Ravenloft.
Well, they had other ones than Ravenloft. That was just the first one. All right, so 2011, a series of player's option books return with yet more new classes, races, feats, and powers. So again, we're getting into that creep of splat books, which is one of the drawbacks to D&D that they've always had. Splat books by the pound.
Right.
So the first adventure, Advanced Dungeons & Dragons episode of the show Community airs. Have you seen those?
No, I have not.
We'll have to sit and watch those sometime. The Community D&D episodes are really cool. 2012, Wizards launches the open playtest of D&D Next, which will ultimately include over 175,000 playtesters. I was one of them. Wizards Dungeon Command Skirmish combat game provides fast-paced tactical miniature warfare on configurable boards. And the board game Lords of Waterdeep brings a competitive dimension of play to the Forgotten Realms setting. Love that game. If you've not played it, I own it. We will play it. 2013, the 1974 original box set Dungeons & Dragons game with its supplements is reprinted with new art cover in a deluxe collector's edition. Lords of Waterdeep appears in an iOS version for the iPad. And beta for Neverwinter MMO, developed by Cryptic Studios, begins in February. The game officially releases in June. 2014, Year 40, the second Advanced Dungeons & Dragons episode of Community airs. 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons is released under lead designer Mike Merles. The initial product is free online version of the D&D basic rules and helps mark the 40th anniversary of the publication of the game. A cross-platform campaign, Tyranny of Dragons, begins in August at Gen Con, with a storyline impacting both tabletop and digital play. Okay, so that gets us through that. I mean, since then, we've hit now the 50th Gen Con, which was this year, 2017.
Correct.
Which I did not go to because I am not insane.
Yes. Now, you said you have only been to Gen Con in Indianapolis.
Yes, in 2007. I've only been to Gen Con once.
Now, I had gone to one in Milwaukee.
Okay.
And I went to the second Gen Con in Indianapolis.
Which would have been 2004?
That sounds about right.
Okay.
I brought my brother-in-law, Casey, who is a huge Magic player. And he was in high school at the time. And so we drove from central Wisconsin to Indianapolis. And fortunately, we had pre-registered all of our stuff. So when we got there Thursday morning, we didn't have to wait in the huge line. We just had to wait in the long line.
Okay.
But it was great. I played no D&D games. But I got to play a six-hour champion session with a GM who flew over from England.
Oh, cool.
To run it.
That's awesome.
And that's kind of one of the things. Like, you're familiar with the Experimental Aircraft Association in Oshkosh and
yep.
their annual fly-in.
Yep.
A lot of people think, well, it's Oshkosh. It's a small town in central Wisconsin. They get people flying their own planes in from dozens of countries. And Gen Con, it bills itself as the world's largest gaming convention, and it probably is. I mean, I haven't compared attendance numbers between it and Origins or Comic-Con mm-hmm. in San Diego, but it is huge.
Oh, yeah.
And as you're walking around, you're hearing easily 8 or 10 different languages being spoken. I got to play in one game that was all in Spanish.
Oh, cool.
And trying to flipping through my dictionary or trying to figure out how to say energy blast in Spanish, which I don't remember off the top of my head anymore because I haven't needed to say it in
right.
a decade. But it's a lot of fun, and you meet so many interesting people through this convention, which really, when you boil it down, grew out of a couple of guys in Lake Geneva getting together to play a game on a Saturday night.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I just want to take a second. I think we need to remember the impact that the guys who created this, Dave Arneson and Gary Gygax, they both passed away within the last, well, I guess, 10 years or so.
Yeah, I think one was 08 and one was 09. Early 09.
Yeah, so Gary Gygax, who's better known as the father of D&D, or at this point, the grandfather of D&D, he was 69 years old. He died in March of 2008. I'll tell a story about Gary in a little bit here. Dave Arneson, I never met Dave, but he passed away in April of 2009. Now, a lot of people that are into our hobby know that somewhere along the way, Gary and Dave kind of had a falling out. And it was over whether or not, you know, whether it was the work that was put into the game or the spark of life, as they call it, of the game, what was more important. So I'm going to read an article here from RPG Stack Exchange, which kind of doesn't delve into it deeply, but it does bring up a few points that I think are very important to this argument. So Gygax felt that the work side of the whole affair counted far more, but Arneson felt that his spark of life was of paramount importance. The debate continues after their passing. Gygax fans claim he was cheated, and Arneson's fans claim he was neglected by both history and Gygax. Before I go any further, Arneson was definitely neglected by history.
Yes.
To understand these conflicting points of view, review this early history. Dave Arneson contributed crucial concepts which, according to the eventual legal ruling, changed the existing and common game form into a unique one. The previous emphasis was on wargaming with miniatures, changed into role-playing with wargame mechanics and terminology also using miniatures. Gary Gygax devoted his life to this new type of game. First, he collected all the ideas and added lots more of his own. Then he wrote everything down, co-founded Tactical Studies Rules with Kay and Bloom, and published. He stayed with it through the rough early days, wrote even more Greyhawk, rode the tiger as D&D took off and generated unexpected amounts of revenue, and paid the cost and stress on himself, his marriage, family, and friends. Arneson continued his life elsewhere and did none of the above. Hence, Gygax felt that Arneson was but one of many contributors and felt that the revenues should go to those who built the company and fueled the D&D boom. Himself first and foremost. In the eventual legal ruling, the Spark of Life, the thing that changed a clever but unremarkable game, the pre-D&D Greyhawk war game campaign, into a unique and special thing, came from Arneson. The judges agreed that without Arneson's contribution, there would not have been a Dungeons & Dragons game at all. I don't know where to stand on that. I never met Dave Arneson.
Right.
I have met Gary Gygax. I have talked on several occasions with Gary Gygax. So I personally, I don't know enough of the backstory to make, make a ruling in any way. But I do tend to agree with the judges on this, that there is a spark of life. Without that, would D&D have become what it was? Probably not. Would something have developed? Possibly. Would it have been Dungeons & Dragons? Who knows? But anyway, so what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I've never met either of them. What I got into role-playing games for was the role. I got into it for the character and because it was a fun way to spend time with friends.
Yep.
Now, a lot of the friends that in college I played these games with were also into games like Axis and Allies and Diplomacy, but some of them were also into Warhammer 40K and more of the tactical miniatures games, which, apart from D&D minis in the 3.5 setting, I never really cared for because it seemed really dry to me.
Yeah, I mean, for me, miniatures, I'm more of a theater of the mind kind of guy.
Right.
It allows me as a GM, when somebody goes, how far away am I from X? And then, you know, depending on where we are in the campaign or the combat or whatever, I can say, well, you're 15 feet away or you're 35 feet away, depending on what needs to happen. Whereas if you have miniatures, there's no question. Oh, you're 3 squares away, you're 15 feet away. Mm-hmm. End of story.
Right.
So
now, for some players, having that visual element is helpful. And a lot of times, it frees up space in their mind to get more creative rather than having it limit their creativity. Because then also, they can get a spatial overview. Okay, I know that this person's here and this person's here, so this is the choice that I'm going to make rather than the unfortunate occurrence of dropping a fireball in the middle of your party.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I have a couple quick Gary stories. So the first time I met Gary Gygax, I was in Lake Geneva at what was at that time called Lake GenevaCon. It has now been renamed GaryCon. But I was there, I think it was about 2005 or 2006. And they had offered a bus tour where you could get on a bus with Gary, and they went around and he showed us where all the old TSR offices were, and he told stories from time, you know, and it was really cool. And I kind of ended up sitting near Gary, so I asked him a lot of questions, and we talked back and forth and stuff, and we get to the end of that, and one of the big things Gary always did was he would invite a group of people for Saturday night of the con to come sit on his porch and play D&D with them. So we get done with the tour and stuff, and then we went back in, and I went and worked at my stand for a while, and then after that closed down, we're walking around, and Gary's sitting there with Tom Wham. I'm sure you know that name. He's a board game designer.
Okay.
And so they're sitting there, and they're play testing Dragon Lairds, which is a new Tom Wham game that he's working on. And Gary looks up, and I guess from talking to people, Gary was really good at recalling names. So he's like, oh, Chad, you want to come and we need more players? And I'm like, yeah. you know. So we sit there and we play Dragon Lairds for a while, which at that stage was not a very good game.
Well, that's why it's being playtested.
Right, exactly. And I don't know, I've never played the final revision of it because it wasn't a very good game. But I thought it was funny that all the cards during the playtest were just pieces of paper taped onto common Magic cards. So, but anyway, we play this game, and Gary goes, well, tomorrow night, he goes, and he says time and whatever. He's like, you want to come over to the house and play D&D with us? And I'm like, really? And I said, well, I said, I'm a vendor here, so I'll have to try to see what. And he goes, okay. He goes, let me know tomorrow. So go back and I try to figure it out. And I just can't come up with a way that makes sense. So I had to go back and tell Gary that, no, I couldn't go play D&D with him. And, I mean, he understood. He was cool about it and all that kind of stuff. And he said, well, you know, maybe next year or whatever. And I'm like, hey, that'd be awesome. Well, we never went back to Lake Geneva Con because it was a old school type of gaming convention. So we didn't sell anything. So, you know, but anyway, fast forward 2007, Gary's at Gen Con. He's signing stuff. There's, you know, so I get in line and I've got my copy of Oriental Adventures and I got my copy of Tomb of Horrors, and I stand in line and I waited like an hour and a half or something. And I get up there and he looks up at me when I'm walking to the table and he goes, he kind of snaps his fingers and he goes, Lake Geneva Con. And I'm like, yeah, I'm like, I remember you, but you know, and he's like, Chad. I'm like, yeah. So I'm like, well, you signed this, and he signed this, and he starts flipping through Tomb of Horrors, and he's like, oh man, it's been so long since I looked through Tomb of Horrors. He goes, why don't you come around back here and sit down? All right.
Sure.
You know, so I go around the table, and Gary and I sit there for like 20 minutes flipping through Tomb of Horrors, and he's laughing, and he's pointing at stuff, and I said, don't ruin too much. I said, because we're playing this right now. And I said, this is the part we're at, you know, with the, and you don't know the thing, but I'm like, and there's this orb inside this demon mouth, you know, and we're trying to figure out what it is. And he looks at me and he goes, all I'm going to say is a snake will bite you. And I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? And, you know, and he's like, and we talk for a while. And after like 15, 20 minutes, I'm like, Gary, I'm like, and he looks up and he kind of looks at me and he goes, oh, they'll wait. We talked for another 5 minutes. So then I get up and I leave, you know, and we're walking around Gen Con, and I was there with Adam and a few other people, and Adam's guy I was in business with. And we see Gary, and I said, hey, look, it's Gary. He's like, yeah. I'm like, you want to meet him? He's like, whatever. And I'm like, come on, let's go. And he's looking at me like, you're an idiot. What are you doing, right? And I walk over there, and Gary looks up, and he's like, oh, hey, Chad, how's it going? We shake hands, and I'm like, hey, this is my business partner, Adam. And Adam's just sitting there like, just dumbfounded.
Yes.
And I'm just like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
that just happened.
You know, so that was 2007. And then Gary passed away in 2008. And I'd actually talked to Gary, and we opened our shop in 2010. I had talked to Gary and he said, you know, whenever you guys open up, let me know. And he said, I'll come up and we'll do a big thing. And I'm like, that's cool. But unfortunately, he passed away before that ever happened. But there you go. There are my Gary stories.
All right. Those are pretty cool.
Yeah, they are. I those are something, you know, those are one of those stories you're going to take with you.
Right.
So, all right. What do you got for us now? I've talked again for a long time.
Yes. But we knew that going in.
Yeah.
So, we've touched on a few things already. We talked about the 2000 D&D movie.
Yep.
There was an even more forgettable sequel, kind of, but...
And then there was a third one.
Yes, but nobody talks about that one.
Well, actually, I heard that was better than the second one, but it was only released in England.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I didn't... The second one... The first one's hard to get through, to be honest with you.
Yes.
The second one was horrid.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've never given the third one a chance.
Yes. Well, you will have a chance for the fourth one.
Are they doing another one?
Yes. Wizards of the Coast and Warner Brothers Studios are actually already in pre-production.
Okay.
For a new movie. They have a lead actor under contract. His name is Ansel Elgort, which they say, well, he's even got a D&D name.
Yeah, kind of.
anybody who might recognize him, he was one of the stars of the Divergent film series.
Okay.
And he was also in the remake of Carrie.
All right.
The writer is David Leslie Johnson. He did Wrath of the Titans, and he is the one writing the new Aquaman script.
Okay.
The upcoming Aquaman movie for DC. A couple of people have said that they'd be really interested in being in it. One of whom is Vin Diesel.
Well, that makes sense. He's a lifelong gamer. Yep. He's a lifelong D&D player.
And then Joe Manganiello.
I know that name.
He plays the lead werewolf on the True Blood TV series that was on HBO.
Okay, yep, yep.
He's done a lot of stuff, but he's a huge gamer as well.
Okay.
In fact, when he finished filming one of his more recent films, the studio he was working with, who owned the rights to D&D at the time for the new movie, said, "What would you like to do?" And he said, "I want to do a good D&D movie." And they said, "Okay, write it up." So he got one of his buddies, who's a playwright, and they sat down for 6 weeks and wrote a script, brought it to the studio. The studio said, "Our license on it is about to lapse. Warner Brothers is going to pick it up. Go talk to them." So he's been talking to Warner Brothers and talking to Wizards of the Coast. And if you go onto YouTube, there is an interview series called Dungeon Life.
Okay.
And they do several interviews with Joe. And one of the ones that I watched is specifically talking about his passion for getting the movie right. And he said, when you look at a lot of the big budget movies nowadays, the superhero movies that flop are the ones that are about fights and special effects. The superhero movies that do extremely well are the ones that are character driven. And he said that was the problem with the first couple of D&D movies. They were the battle and special effects. They really didn't give the actors a chance to develop the characters.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And bring them to the fore. So, but they did a table read for the script that he and his friend wrote, and he kind of joked that even his wife liked it, and his wife has no experience with D&D, has never been a gamer or anything.
Right.
But she said it's kind of like a romance film, that it's the story of the characters, not the story of the setting.
And really, when we play, it's about our characters. It's not about the setting. So that makes perfect sense.
So, and then another thing we talked about was the animated series. Okay, back in 83, the main characters that appeared on a regular basis for all 27 episodes were Hank the Ranger, Presto the Magician, Eric the Cavalier, Sheila the Thief, Diana the Acrobat, Bobby the Barbarian, the Dungeon Master, and Venger.
Venger.
Now, one thing I thought was kind of interesting was Hank the Ranger and Presto the Magician were voiced by Willie Ames, was Hank the Ranger.
Okay.
And Adam Rich was Presto the Magician. Fans of late 70s, early 80s family TV shows will recognize both those names. They were the two younger of the three brothers on Eight is Enough.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, unfortunately, both of them, after Eight is Enough and after the D&D animated series, got into trouble, and even before then got into trouble. Fortunately, at this point in their life, they've gotten their stuff straightened out. What's interesting is Willie Ames, after the D&D animated series, became a born-again Christian and is now currently the character Bible Man.
Okay.
So, and then a little tidbit about Adam Rich. Back in 1996, Might Magazine ran a spoof article of celebrities who had died.
Okay.
And even though Adam Rich was alive, they listed him as dead and even published a fake obituary for him.
Oh, boy.
And it actually caused a certain amount of trouble because Actors Equity thought that he was dead, and so they stopped his residuals and his insurance.
Oh,
and
my
stuff.
God. So then I'm guessing there was a lawsuit?
No, they got it all straightened out.
Oh, okay.
But
It's like when Hawkeye died on MASH.
Right. So, Eric the Cavalier was voiced by Don Most.
Okay.
Those of you who are Happy Days fans would have seen him listed as Donnie Most. He played Ralph Malph.
Yeah.
So, which is kind of interesting. Dungeon Master was voiced by TV director Sidney Miller. He wasn't actually an actor. He was primarily a TV director, but they liked his voice, and they liked the way that he was able to give the intonations of someone who is in charge and controlling the setting to the character of Dungeon Master.
And, you know, Dungeon Master was that show.
Right.
I mean, really. But
so, and then Venger was voiced by Peter Cullen. Many people will recognize the name if they stick around for the end of the Transformers movies to look at the credits, because he was Optimus Prime.
Okay. Okay.
So, and one thing I thought was interesting was they listed Frank Welker many, many voices.
I know Frank did Uni.
Mm-hmm.
The Unicorn, which is one of the main characters you didn't list.
True.
Uni was in every episode.
Yes.
And was annoying, because all it did was kind of bray
mm-hmm.
when it got scared, and otherwise it just really didn't make much noise. Like a lot of the animal characters in the 80s, there was Snarf and, you know, all these different ones where they were just comic relief, I
exactly.
guess.
Or a plot device.
Plot device.
Uni
yeah.
gets kidnapped.
Yeah.
Bobby goes nuts and chases off, and then everybody has to go rescue Bobby.
Yeah, because the barbarian, you know, he rages, man.
Yes. And he was a little kid.
Yeah.
So, and he was the younger brother of Sheila the Thief.
Right.
So, I thought that was kind of interesting. But the actress who played Sheila the Thief was actually a traditional voice actress. Almost all of her credits are animation.
Okay.
Muppet Babies, Despicable Me, stuff like that.
Oh, Muppet Babies. I love Muppet Babies. Anyway, we're talking D&D.
So, but as we mentioned before, there's Gen Con. This year, 2017, was its 50th anniversary. It is huge. But as we talk, Gen Con spawned Origins. There's connections to Comic-Con. There are conventions all around the world. And they make probably an aggregate billions of dollars.
Oh, yeah, I would assume so.
Not just for the convention itself, but ancillary businesses, hotels in the area, the restaurants, car rental, airline for people flying in. Because for some of these cons, people fly in from all over the world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And in fact, a couple of years ago, we were looking at going to Gen Con again in Indianapolis, and that was the summer that there was the controversial bathroom bill and everything. And a lot of people say that Gen Con's threatening to move from Indianapolis was one of the major factors in that bill getting repealed.
And I absolutely believe that.
Right. So here we have what started off as just a game has evolved to the point where it can actually be an agent of social change. Now, unfortunately, it's also generated backlash. There have been several incidents over the years where people have gotten a little carried away with it, or people have misunderstood what was going on, especially when live-action role play started to come out.
Mm-hmm.
There have been also some people who, unfortunately, probably suffered from schizophrenia, dissociative identity disorder, who felt that the game was real and acted on it, and unfortunately, especially in the early days, because of the stigma attached to it, friends, family, doctors just wrote it off as the game and missed some of the warning signs for these poor people who had these mental troubles. So, but now, as I've mentioned before, I teach high school English. I'm the advisor for our school's gaming club.
Mm-hmm.
But in the past, I've used D&D and other role-playing games as entryways to creative writing or entryways for students who struggle with reading.
Okay.
Because they provide a nice framework for people who are struggling to accomplish these particular goals. Because it breaks it down. And you were talking about with that one Dragon magazine, it had that percentile chart that you rolled on.
Yeah.
And I can use something like that from one of the rulebooks. Okay, roll this about your character. Okay, this is what you got. Now, explain to me why your character has this. And then they come up with the story, or they come up with something, and then they write it down, and then we build on it. And then I say, okay, you've got 15 things written down about this character. Now go put it all together and write me a one-page bio of this person. And they can do it through this framework.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's when I was talking about in terms of education, that's how I use it.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. I've heard it being used to work with mathematical issues, because I've heard of teachers who will take like a combat scenario, and then you roll your dice and you do all the math in order to. I mean, it's basic math,
right?
But if you're struggling with basic math and you can put it into a system of fun, you start to learn math and you don't even know you're learning math.
Right, and from basic addition and subtraction, like keeping track of hit points, now all of a sudden you can move into probability. Okay, do you want a weapon that does 1d12, or do you want a weapon that does 2d6?
I want 2d6.
Right. Because both of them max at 12, but you've got a much higher percentage chance of getting somewhere in the middle with the 2d6, whereas with the 1d12, yeah, you might get the 12,
but you might get the one. And with 2d6, you don't ever get one.
Right. You at least get two, so your minimum has been doubled.
Right. Yep. All right, what else you got for us?
That's pretty much it. A lot of what we've talked about throughout touched on the economics. We talked about the explosion of subscription to Dragon Magazine when it went from bi-monthly to monthly.
Mm-hmm.
And we've really hit a lot of the elements of how Dungeons & Dragons has affected society, really.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not just an isolated element of pop culture anymore. I mean, one of my TV shows that I watch on Netflix is Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched an episode a couple of weeks ago, and I had to text you about it, because here it is, a sci-fi superhero-type TV show. Bad guy's about to escape, opens the door, one of the heroes is standing there, who has attached a giant axe blade to the end of his shotgun so that when he runs out of ammo, he can swing it like an axe. And the door opens, the villain takes a step back because they're surprised, the guy swings the axe, cuts the bad guy's head off, and just stands there, looks, and says, roll crit.
yep, nope. I think you're absolutely right. All right, I think we're going to call this one to an end. Ladies and gentlemen out there, we went a little long this week. But as always, if you want to reach out to us and give us feedback on this episode or any of our other episodes, you can do that. You can drop us an email at wanttohearsomethinginteresting@gmail.com. Or if you're more into the social media thing, you can find us on Facebook at POI Network or at Want to Hear Something Interesting. So once again, thanks for listening, and we will talk to you all next month.
You have been listening to a program from the Point of Insanity Network. Visit us at poigamestudio.podbean.com for more shows. Follow us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at POI Game Studio.